I speak to you as a preacher who's often, I totally resonate with everything you say, especially when people come to me and say, what do I do? Yeah, but how do we get this through? Is there any hope to Pharisees and elder brothers? Hmm. Have you had luck with that? And in what ways?
No, there are no formulas. Just because I can't change and you can't change hearts, you know? I think for me, not buckling under the pressure. You know, I mean, we had a couple. My wife came home on Tuesday and told me that a couple that we know and like a lot are leaving our church to go to another church. And when my wife, Kim, asked why, she said, because my husband and I just need to be told what to do more. And, you know, I mean, those things are heart-wrenching. You know, I mean, these are people we like. When people we don't like say that, we're like, thank God. See you later. But this was actually a couple that we liked. You know, I told my wife, I said, this message confronts the human condition. This isn't a battle between personalities. I mean, this message really does confront the human condition. We are, ever since Genesis chapter 3, we have been addicted to being our own God, addicted to control, addicted to saving ourselves, addicted to establishing our own righteousness. And for whatever reason, we've come to believe that if we can just develop a checklist and successfully check off the boxes on our list, we'll experience our best life now, you know? Is there hope? Yes, because the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Absolutely. I never lose hope. Because I know that God has the power to break through unbelief. But as Luther said, the sin underneath every sin is unbelief. That's the root of all of our sin. And that's what we're battling. And so I would just simply encourage you to press on. It's amazing. Whenever I hear objections, I preach it with more fervor. I don't back off. I press the gas. Sometimes that gets me in trouble, but I mean, I just, you know, it's the Apostle Paul. He was addressing a different issue, but you know, in Romans chapter 4 and 5, he speaks about the radicality of the gospel and the scandalous nature of God's mercy, and then he anticipates the typical question, you know, okay, so what does this mean? Chapter 6, should we go on sinning so that grace may abound? And you would expect Paul at that point to sort of put the brakes on grace and balance everything he said with law, give them a to-do list, a checklist of ways they can evaluate themselves to determine whether or not they're really Christians. You'd think, you know, it'd be tempting to do that. But he doesn't. He says, if that's your question, you obviously, it's not that you get grace too much, it's that you get it too little. So he presses it in deeper. I mean, he floors it. And he goes deeper into the gospel. That's sort of been my MO. You know, when I hear people not getting it, it makes me press it deeper. You know, after a while, to be honest with you, the people who just won't give up, they'll leave. They will. And what will happen is word, and this is what's happened at our church, word will get out that this is what the message is there. And before long, you see a brand new church populated with burned out, broken people who see this message as their only hope and lifeline. And that changes everything. But, you know, we'll continue to have thorns in our side in the form of people. So anyway, I don't know if that helps, but.
Thanks. My name's Mark Davidson. I am on the vestry of an Episcopal church. And I promise you that Dave did not put me up to this or pay me any money to say this, but one of the things that happens to me, this is my second Mockingbird conference, one of the things that happens to me when I leave is I feel so utterly grateful to Jesus that I just want to do anything for him. Hmm. That's not the normal mode of my heart. Hmm. But it, one of the ways that, I, and again, he did not put me up to saying this, but I actually feel like giving a lot of money to Mockingbird, right? And that's because nobody asks me to do this, right? There's nobody saying, you know, you really, really need to do this. This is really, really important. Yeah. And, we need your support desperately. And if you don't do this, it's all going to crash. Right? All this kind of stuff.
Don't forget about Liberate now.
Well, okay. Yes. I've been there. But what I will say is that when it comes to my church, we think a lot about our stewardship campaigns. And I give to my church because I'm supposed to. I give regularly, and I give very cautiously. And we have had so many discussions about how to get people to give more money. We've had all of the strategies. We've talked about Myers-Briggs tests, about why people are motivated, and different kinds of people are motivated in different ways, and how do we do this, and we brainstorm, and we put things in the bulletin, and we have people stand up and give testimonies. And we have actually this year, as a result of all these things, had an increase. It has worked. But it isn't what you're talking about. It's not like, I'll do anything for this church. Look, here's as much money as I can possibly give you. So what does the gospel have to say to churches when it comes to stewardship campaigns?
Yeah, that's good. I couple things. One, I have said before our church before, I could stand up and guilt you into writing some big checks. You know, I could literally stand up and say, I know there are people in this church who have three homes and two pews over is someone who's homeless. And I know some of you have three cars, and I know a single mom who has to take the bus to work every day. And I could do that because those stats are real in our church. And I said, I could do that and make you rich people feel like crap. And you would probably write two or three really big checks. But you'll never write 200 or 300 big checks unless something greater than fear and guilt motivates you. And that's what Paul does in Corinthians. He says, let me tell you about the Macedonians. Okay, hey, Corinthians, let me tell you about the Macedonians. These people are poor. And they've given us everything. In fact, they keep coming back to us and asking us if they can give more and more and more. We can't stop them from even asking, and these people have nothing. And he begins that section by saying, let me tell you about the effect that grace is having with the Macedonians. And then he talks about their generosity. And then he goes on. In this is 2 Corinthians 8, and then verse 8 and 9, he says, because Jesus became poor for you so that you might become rich. And he goes on to describe, and I told our church, I said, that's the generosity can only happen, bona fide generosity can only happen to those whose hearts are grasped by the radical generosity of Jesus. So I told our church, I said, the real test of whether or not you guys are starting to get this is if I never have to preach a giving sermon. You know? If you guys become like the grace of God has so radically transformed you on the inside that you're like, we want to give more. I mean, checks just pile in. You know, we haven't reached that point yet, so I keep preaching the gospel. I don't have a manual on stewardship. It's just, I do think that giving is a fruit of a heart that has been grasped by God's grace. And I'll say this too, real quick. When you ask the question, so what are you going to do now that you don't have to do anything? What you discover, at least what I've discovered in my own life, is that when you realize you don't have to do anything for Jesus, something miraculous happens. You actually begin wanting to do everything for Jesus. So, anyway. Oh, no.
Here we go.
Good God. Please. Isn't it time for the next session?
Sorry. No.
Wait a second. Before you ask a question, Jim, let me just tell you why I said that about Jim. All right. Jim McNeely is a good friend from Washington State. He was at the first Liberate conference, not this past February. So February 2012, right? And we're doing a question and answer period. And Jim felt like the Q&A was, you know, people weren't really being honest. They weren't really being open and transparent. So Jim decided to get the ball rolling. So he said, you know, I have a son that, I got to be honest with you, sometimes I dream about grabbing my gun and shooting him in the face. Does anybody else feel that? And everyone's like, oh, my God. I mean, the security people and the police officers on set were like looking at me like, I was like, nah, it's fine. I feel the same way about my son. I just don't say it. Anyway, so go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Great. I was gratified recently, and I've seen a little more. I've seen more of this where people that leaders, church leaders, and Christian leaders are alarmed about the spread of the hyper-grace movement.
Of the what right? movement?
That's what they said.
Hyper grace movement.
Hyper
gotcha.
Grace.
Right.
Gotcha. Right. That's what that in this particular article. That's what they were saying.
Sure.
And you know, I took the liberty of writing a scathing response to it, but
it was a great response. I read it.
Yeah. But the thing that actually gratified me was that. Reading through that site, there's a number of people that are alarmed about the spread of the grace movement, which I take as a tremendous victory,
yeah.
Right? Although when I look around, I'm not sure I'm as convinced of the success of the spread of it yet. You know, I feel like I'm still fighting, and I feel like I'm pretty isolated where I am.
Hmm.
When you look out at the landscape of North America...
Hmm.
How successful are we at doing this?
Hmm.
Are we really? Is it spreading that alarmingly fast, or you know, are we succeeding, or what's
yeah.
the state?
Gosh, I mean, there are
Sorry.
The what?
I said glory.
Yes, we are succeeding. Overpowering and conquering the world. There are pockets of encouraging places, you know. This is one of them. I live my life in the evangelical world. And, you know, there are probably more places that discourage me and frustrate me than there are places that encourage me. I think there is an acknowledgement. What Christian doesn't want to acknowledge the reality of grace, at least theologically? But there's still a lot of buts and breaks. Lots of buts and breaks. Yes, grace, but the very fact that people would refer to this as the radical grace movement or the hyper grace movement seems to suggest that that there's grace and then there's radical grace, or there's grace and then there's hyper grace. I don't know another grace that isn't hyper or radical. I mean, it's that counterintuitive. It turns everything upside down and inside out and wrecks all of our conditional categories. And so I don't know. I mean, I do look, in all honesty, I look at Mockingbird, I look at Liberate, I look at the pastors who come to Mockingbird and Liberate, the ones that we interact with, the ones who have tried it the other way, who have crashed and burned, and are starting to get it now, and they want help in how they should go about sort of changing the way they do ministry and changing the way they preach and that sort of thing. So, I think there are a few of us who are willing to take the shots and get it out there as far and wide as possible. We can sow and we can plant, but God alone gives the increase. That's God's business. So whether it spreads or not doesn't determine whether I'm going to say what saved my life or not. And just sort of leave that stuff up to God. But I could go into much more detail, but that'll be in private. And then we can talk names and people and, you know, really slam some people and throw them under the bus. But I won't do that publicly.
I've really appreciated your honesty up front. And I loved how you shared briefly about how a couple had come and said that you really liked. You know, I have those people in my parish too, and they're like, well, we're just going to go on somewhere else because we want something to do. And you're like, great, we'll pray for you. But the people that you do like and that you've had relationships with, because we've had that too, you know, and they're like, we're moving on, and you've really liked them. And it's like a personal, like, you leave, I mean, you're not happy about that at all, and you feel rejected. How have you and your wife coped with that rejection when, you know, parishioners and friends have said, you know, this, you've lost your mind.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I mean, gosh, there's no real simple answer to that. I think it stings every time it happens. I have to go back and say, what is it that stings? What's the stinger about that? And if I'm honest, I'll say the reason I take it personally is because this is a rejection of me. Seriously, I'm not being trite when I say this. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about the now power of the gospel. It saves me in those moments because it's a reminder, it's a doxological declaration that because I have been forever approved and accepted by God because of what Jesus has done, I'm free to be rejected. In other words, this isn't really about me. Who I am has nothing to do with me. Fundamentally, my identity, my value, my worth has nothing to do with what I can do or what I can get other people to think about me. It's what Jesus has accomplished on my behalf. So what that frees me to do is when they leave, I honestly can love them and keep up with them. Like, so my wife and I, for instance, are literally this coming up Monday, are taking them out to lunch. And my goal at that point is not to convince them to stay. My goal at that point is to say, whether you stay or go, I love you. And only the gospel can free you to do that. Because I don't need you to think I'm great in order to feel like I matter. It's hard. It's hard. It's hard on my wife. You know, it is. I mean, she was crying the other day. She said, I used to hear stories from pastors about ministry being a lonely place. And I just didn't even know what they were talking about. Because we'd always been in places and surrounded by people who loved us. And now I'm starting to get a sense of what they were talking about. You know, she gets afraid. I get afraid, you know, to invest deeply in the people who come. Because what if they leave one day? You know, do I really want to invest in someone who God might take out of my life? And if you've been a pastor for a long period of time, you know you've been hurt by enough people who have left your church, friends who have left, people who have left throwing mud at you. It's hard. You know, you kind of keep your cards close to the chest. And this is why this message alone can save you from that. Because I can give and give and give and give and give because I don't need anything from you. And even if you slap me in the face, I can give. I can kiss. I can return a slap with a kiss. Because I have everything I need. Now, we never believe that fully, which is why we have to keep preaching it to ourselves and to other people. Like Luther said, we have to preach the gospel to ourselves every day because we forget it every day. And we have to preach the gospel to our people every week because they forget it every week. So, anyway.
You have to admit, when you're, like, really tan,
yeah,
your skin is thicker.
It is.
From, like,
my skin is like leather.
Criticism.
I sent a picture last night of RJ and me to Aaron Zimmerman and said, we miss you, you know, took a picture of us. And he says, does George Harrison know that you stole his tan? I was like, just shut up and go to sleep, Aaron.
George Hamilton, I think you meant.
Yeah, George Hamilton.
Yeah, Harrison.
Who did I say? Harrison?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he wasn't very tan. He was from. No, he was white as a ghost. George. Yeah, George Hamilton. He's the guy with the tan and the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad we cleared that up.
Yeah, I'm glad we did too.
On that note, I would like to ask people just to hold the rest of the questions until after I get a chance to speak.
All right? Because you'll probably answer all their questions.
Yeah, exactly. just wait till you hear what I have to say. Thank you again, Tullian. Yeah.